From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight we're going to start with a new guest. Jason Miller is a author, of course. He has a new book out called Obamacare, Healthcare Apocalypse. Jason Miller is also a writer whose works have appeared in the Washington Times, Medscape Journal of Medicine and Modern Healthcare, Pennsylvania Outdoor News, and the Lawyer's Journal. And he received his law degree from the University of Pittsburgh School of Law with a certificate in health law. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to start a little bit with, we're going to get into obviously Obamacare in the book, and for those of you that are looking at the show notes, there's a link on how to pick up the book. I think we have the Amazon link there. But I want to talk a little bit about, as you know, my program originates from Canada, although it's broadcast across North America. A good chunk of my listeners are in the United States and are very interested in Obamacare. But what about the comparison between Canadian healthcare and what Obama is trying to put forward? You and I could do a whole other show on that one.
Right. I think it's a topic into itself. There are some parallels here with what the Obamacare health law is trying to create with what has been established in Canada. But I think before you could even explore what's occurring here with what has occurred in Canada, it's important to note that there are significant cultural differences, you know, between the borders. And if there are problems with the system in Canada as it is today, there's no guarantee that there would be parallel problems or that they would not be more severe in the United States because of those cultural differences. And the expectation that's evolved over time in the United States with health care coverage being predominantly employment-based and the product of a third-party payer system. So by way of any comparison, I think, you know, there's a major obstacle with the cultural differences between the two countries. And like you pointed out, it's a topic that could take up a show of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Michael Moores and all those out there that think the Canadian healthcare system is so wonderful, come on up here. We have 30-some million people. You have 300-and-some million people. It's not hard to figure out what kind of a disaster that would be.
I didn't want to be too critical of the Canadian system, just because I'm here to talk about Obamacare and its impact in the United States. It's a vast change from what we've had in this country in the past. And, you know, let me ask you, what's the overall consensus about the system in Canada today?
Well, you're asking me, like I said before, is we could sit down and do a whole new show. wait times, doctor shortages, you name it, we could go on and on and on. So it's not all what it's cracked up to be. When you talk about socialized medicine and sitting down and analyzing it, that's a whole series of shows. But what about the book, Obamacare, Healthcare Apocalypse? What made you sit down and write it?
Well, I think it's important to let everyone know that what the law was purported to accomplish to the American people, and that is predominantly reform of the American healthcare insurance industry, it's as if it's a ruse. I think it's intended to ultimately lead to socialized medicine, and the product will be the same problems that you have in the Canadian system. I know that you pointed out the doctor shortages. Interestingly enough, the Obamacare health law, although it's over 400,000 words long, there's very little emphasis on the provider side.
Yeah.
So something as simple as, you know, encouraging or establishing perhaps a three-year PCP track in medical schools as opposed to requiring PCPs to go through the same four-year program as other specialists that are ultimately then paid at a higher rate. The law is devoid of those types of nuances that could enhance the current American healthcare system as opposed to, you know, supplanting it and replacing it ultimately with socialized medicine.
Author Jason Miller is here. He's a healthcare attorney, and his new book, Obamacare, Healthcare Apocalypse, is available now. There's a link in the show notes, and I'll find it. I've made some talking points. Your PR people and I sat down and talked about it, and I think that's the best way to go through this interview. So I'm going to ask the questions, and I'll get you to answer them. We've heard lots of promises, of course, in the media, and we're going to make this perfectly clear tonight that you may not be able to keep the health care that you have today. What about that and Obamacare?
So we heard the promises in the summer of 2009, before the law was, I hesitate to say passed through Congress, you know, forced through Congress is more like it.
Right.
The promise was very clear. If you like your doctor, and if you like your health care plan, that's not going to change. You can keep the coverage that you have today. This past fall, we saw the reality of what this healthcare law means. And the issue surfaced when a number of individual plans were canceled by the carriers. And the reason that they were canceled is because they failed to continue to meet the grandfathered plan status, which is contained in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And essentially what that provision says is if you're covered under a plan that was in effect on the date that President Obama signed the PPACA into law, which was March 10, 2013, and at least one individual has maintained coverage under that plan since that date, then it's considered a grandfathered plan. And therefore, it's not subject to additional requirements that are imposed by Obamacare, the majority of which kicked into effect on January 1st of this year. Now, the law, while it is as extensive as it is, doesn't say all that much about what it takes to lose that grandfather health plan status. Instead, what we have is, and this is a common theme throughout the law, is that it defers heavily to multiple regulatory agencies that are able to establish very stringent requirements without full congressional approval. And so something as simple as a nominal increase in a copay can cost a health plan its grandfathered plan status. And that's what we've seen occur with the individual cancellations. Now, another fallacy in that statement or that promise that was made back in the summer of 2009 is that it improperly implies that the individual will always have the ability to determine what plan to retain.
Right.
You know, in America, the majority of individuals are covered under a group health plan based upon their employment. And so it's not the individual's call to make. If something cheaper comes along the line, it's the employer's decision to make. So, you know, we've seen the first round of issues with that failed promise. And I think as time goes on, as the delayed employer mandate kicks in and we see other facets of Obamacare start to have a negative and detrimental effect on healthcare in America, I think we're going to see additional cancellations, and it's going to be in that group setting where the individual really has no say in it, and it all comes down to an employer cost-benefit analysis as to whether it's more economical to pay for a qualified health plan or simply just pay the penalty.
Now, when we talk about uninsured Americans, and that was big in the preamble to all of this, getting health coverage for everyone, that's all you heard the talking heads on the cable news shows talking about. It's not that simple, is it, when it comes to addressing the problems of those uninsured Americans?
It's not. And you know, in 2009, I believe the uninsured rate in America was around 15%. I really do think that what the Obamacare law does is it doesn't close the gap between insured and uninsured, ultimately it's going to create a shift in uninsured to the middle class. With the massive Medicaid expansion for the states that have opted into the additional federal funding, any individual without any other coterminous requirements can qualify for Medicaid simply based upon income. If you're under 138% of the federal poverty level, then you qualify if you're in one of those states. No reasonable safeguards or fail-safes in place to prevent overutilization or exploitation of the Medicaid system. For instance, there's no requirement that states impose additional cost sharing for inappropriate emergency room usage. That's an issue we see with Medicaid expansion is emergency room utilization goes up. And if you compare the Medicaid line to private insurance, the way a lot of private health plans have combated that more expensive and inappropriate utilization in the emergency room is by creating a higher copayment. If you present to the emergency room and it doesn't lead to an admission, then you have, say, $150 copay. If you're admitted and it was a legitimate emergency room visit, then that copay is waived. What this does is it incentivizes the individual because they have skin in the game. They have a financial interest at that point in obtaining the most appropriate and most economical care. So if you have an issue that doesn't necessarily require an emergency room visit, you're going to seek out, I don't know if you have a lot of urgent care centers yet in Canada, but they're popping up all over the place in the United States, and it's kind of like a mini freestanding minor version of an emergency room.
Right.
It's quick, efficient, and it's an appropriate alternative. If you require something that wouldn't necessarily arise to an emergency and it's off hours and it's not a time of the day when you can easily get a doctor's appointment. But we don't see any of those safeguards in place with the Medicaid expansion. It's simply an income-based eligibility requirement, and that's it.
Well, they're showing up here because doctor shortages are causing ERs to close at night, believe it or not, and we're popping up these little clinics here and there, and they tell the folks if you have problems, go to them. But again, that's a whole other topic. Jason Miller's here talking about his book, Obamacare, The Healthcare Apocalypse. Getting back to the book here a little bit, when you mention Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and how many pages it is, and for the confusion for Joe and Mary Sixpack that are sitting at home trying to figure out what is this all about? How is it going to affect me? How will the book help those Americans that are wanting to know just what I said? How will this affect me?
Well, I explain in the book what the gist of the law is. You know, there are a number of books that delve into Obamacare. I do this in one chapter. I explain what Obamacare prohibits, and I explain what Obamacare requires, and then I delve into what Obamacare costs. And costs, obviously, in the realm of Obamacare equals taxes, additional taxes. So I just lay it all out right at the beginning, just a very quick, in very simple terms, a summary of the core requirements, prohibitions, and costs that are related to the Act. And then I explain the evolution of health care and how and why it became such a cost factor. I get into how technology entered the realm, the associated costs with research and development, and how that's caused healthcare to hop onto this escalating cost balloon, if you will, that seems to have no end. Then I get into how the practical realities of the healthcare law are going to play out. And I believe that what we have here is something called, that I call in the book, a recipe for financial disaster. And the industry that faces that financial disaster, I believe, is the private healthcare industry in the United States. What this law does is it imposes very stringent requirements on insurance companies without any fail-safes or any reasonable checks to prevent what has been referred to as the death spin. In my book, I call it the downward spiral. And what we have under this health care law is you have guaranteed issue, no pre-existing condition exclusions permissible. And to offset some of these concerns, what the drafters of the act implemented were the individual and employer mandates. Now, in theory, and that's what was presented to the public and to Congress before this was passed, you know, the mandates are going to ensure that everyone maintains coverage and that the risk pool is not depleted and that the law would be a success and it's not going to impact the third-party payer system in America. Now, the practical reality of it is, because of the very stringent requirements that the Act imposes upon the healthcare insurance industry, we're already seeing skyrocketing premiums, and that's going to continue. But the mandates, which, you know, the employer mandate on July 3rd was extended by yet another year, but even when it does come into play, it's very weak in comparison to the cost of coverage. You know, we're looking at premiums that are upwards of $12,000 per year.
Jeez.
And the employer penalty, it varies based upon whether the employer offers any coverage at all or offers coverage that doesn't qualify based upon affordability and adequacy requirements. And, you know, the greater of the two is $3,000 per year per employee, but it doesn't kick in until after the 30th employee. So it doesn't take a lot of math skills to figure out what's going to be much more economical. And I think as the employer mandate does come into play, we're going to see all the things, all the concerns about the impact on jobs, we're going to start to see those occur. Those have kind of been put on the back burner. The concerns have been put on hold because the employer mandate should have put on hold. But, you know, with the employer mandate, there's what I like to call the 50-30 rule. And the 50-30 rule is the mandate only kicks in for employers that have 50 or more full-time employees.
Right.
And the penalty is only accrued with respect to those employees that work 30 or more hours per week. So once the employer mandate does come into play, I think we're going to see a lot of companies that are just over the 50 threshold downsize. I think we're going to see stunted growth with those mid-sized employers who don't wish to, you know, hit the additional cost associated with growth and climbing above that 50 employee mark. We saw a number of employers toy with the idea of reducing employee hours to below 30. The Darden Group, which is manages a lot of large restaurant chains,
right,
tossed that idea around publicly not long ago. So I think as it all comes into full implementation, I think we're going to see job loss. We're going to see other employers who are simply going to look at the cost of providing coverage, which is going to grow as this law continues to remain in effect, and simply choose to pay the lesser of the two, which is a penalty. On top of that, then the individual is going to be faced with an individual penalty for not obtaining coverage.
Right.
But once again, the cost of the penalty is a fraction of the cost of obtaining coverage. So the first year, the penalty is the greater of $96 or 1% of adjusted gross income. And if you look at the cost of an individual plan out there today, for any individual who's not subsidy eligible under the healthcare law, if you're young and you're healthy, it's a no-brainer. And there are reports out now, the numbers are coming out, and the number of enrollees has been reported at 2.2 million under the Affordable Care Act website, and I believe it's less than one-fourth of them are in that the young and healthy demographic that's needed to balance out the risk pool. And earlier numbers that I had seen were reporting that, you know, 40% of that demographic would need to sign up in order to balance everything out. So I really think that what we're going to see with this law is that unfortunate downward spiral of the healthcare insurance industry. And it's just going to be a vicious cycle, and the impact is going to be a shift in the uninsured to the middle class until the middle class has no choice but to accept further expansion of socialized medicine.
Jason Miller's here for a couple more minutes, and I'm going to give you the last word here in a second. But his book, Obamacare, Healthcare Apocalypse, is available. Just click on the link in the show notes. Any, you're an attorney, any regulation that has penalties has to have enforcement. How in heaven's name are they going to enforce this?
It's going to be enforced by, with respect to any tax return that the individual would receive, it will be taken off of that tax return.
There you go.
However, the law specifically carves out certain other penalties that are inherent in all other IRS enforcement actions. So there's no, the enforcement is going to be very limited with respect to, if you compare it to any other tax. And that's something that the Supreme Court, particularly the justices who wrote the dissenting opinion, discussed in the National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius law, and that's obviously the law that upheld the Affordable Care Act in its entirety,
right,
with the one exception being that the states can't be compelled to expand their current Medicaid programs under the duress of potential loss of the funding that they receive today.
Well, it'll be interesting. Listen, Jason, we're out of time. The book, Obamacare, Healthcare Apocalypse, is available. Thank you, sir, and we'll do this again because there's lots more to talk about.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for discussing this book with me. It's an important topic, and, you know, I really like to get into the comparison with you between what this law is going to create and the Canadian system. I think that's a great topic that you brought up, that it's worthy of further exploration.
Absolutely. I'll be in touch. Talk to you later.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Jason Miller, and he is a attorney, healthcare attorney, and I brought him on tonight to talk about Obamacare because it's going to be an abomination, that's for sure. We're going to take a break and come back with a former police officer. There you go. Right after my heart, who is an expert in elder abuse issues. Lillian Jeter will be here. She's a former law enforcement commander who uncovered a case of elder abuse and neglect in 1985 that changed the nation's whole perspective on the mistreatment of vulnerable older persons. So we're going to take a break here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. My next guest, Lillian Jeter, is an expert in elder abuse issues. She's a former law enforcement commander who uncovered a case of elder abuse and neglect in 1985 that changed the nation's whole perspective on the mistreatment of vulnerable older persons. She is now a senior advisor for the Billiken Group, as well as an advisor member for the Institute of Violence, Abuse, and Trauma in Hawaii. At the end of her career in law enforcement, she was a deputy director of the South Carolina Police Corps at the Citadel. Good evening, ma'am. How are you?
Good evening, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome to the program from one law enforcement officer to another.
Well, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Now, elder abuse. You know, a lot of people, and I try to cover topics on this program that people may think about now and then, but really don't understand a whole heck of a lot about it. So let's talk about elder abuse and just define it for me briefly, and we'll get into signs and symptoms and laws and all that sort of stuff in a minute.
Well, I think the best comparison is to think about child abuse. And everybody knows pretty well if, you know, what it is when a child is being abused, you know, the neglect, the physical abuse, unfortunately, sometimes sexual abuse, lack of food, lack of nourishment, lack of care, all of those different degrees. The only thing that we're doing in elder abuse is we're putting it up to the top of the aging spectrum. So now you have people at an adult age who are sometimes incapacitated, sometimes with dementia. In other words, they're not capable of leading a life that they can do by themselves, so to speak, live a normal life at that particular age in those particular circumstances, whether it be by disease or whatever the case may be. So they have to have someone else to help them. If they're at home, it might be a spouse, it might be a family member. And the elder abuse comes in because of this dependency on others, or it might be they're in a nursing home or assisted facility. It's that dependence and reliability on others at that stage of life where they're very weakened and they're not totally confident that the types of abuse come in. Physical abuse, hitting, striking, hurting them in some way with physical objects. There's neglect where there's withholding of food, withholding of care, nourishment, all those basic daily needs that we have. Sexual abuse, molestation, full sexual abuse, other things that are very demeaning, as you can well imagine, to somebody in this particular situation. There's also financial exploitation where all of their hard-earned monies that they might have spent during a career are now being taken away and handled and mishandled by this supposedly what they call a carer that's in charge of their life. And then the final one is psychological abuse, which is not a physical strike or a blow, but it's using verbiage and language and yelling and screaming, the calling of names, the putting down of the person on a daily basis. So those five categories are what we call elder abuse to those who can no longer take care of themselves and rely on some type of carer or caregiver in their daily lives to get them through that day and on to the next day.
Yeah, checking on the links in the show notes, click on the link for Lillian and you'll learn more about her. Lillian is a law enforcement officer. You investigated many cases of elder abuse. I have too. And what we learn early, Police Work 101, is you need a witness. And if you are dealing with someone who is suffering sadly from Alzheimer's or dementia or whatever. A lot of these cases are financial where the kid or relative has signed a power of attorney, so they're spending mom or grandma's money like crazy and they're threatening them to get them to sign the checks, et cetera, et cetera. What do we do as law enforcement? What do we do as in the courts and in the system to try and protect those people because they just may not be able to testify?
Well, the first thing to do, Dana, is get the report out to begin with. These people are normally behind closed doors. They're either in nursing homes or they're in the community behind closed doors. You know, a lot of people we say, oh, well, it only happens in, you know, the nursing home setting.
No.
Well, that's not true. There's only 5% of older adults, incapacitated adults, are in that type of setting. There's 95% of older adults who are still in our communities all over the world. But it's the ones that are behind closed doors that don't have that neighbor or that friend or that other family member coming in to check on them, and thus the abuse becomes hidden. So it's those are the eyes and ears, especially the neighbors that can see there's something wrong with their, or the family member that's the abusive caregiver does not allow them to come in the door to visit. These are telltale signs that indicate abuse. So the first thing is to discover it to begin with. Now, I don't know about Canada. I'm sure they have. Are you in Canada? Is that correct?
That's right.
I'm pretty sure that they have mandatory reporting laws in Canada. They do in the United States except for 4 states. And that means that those that are medical personnel or those categories of people that deal with older persons in these type of positions where they are behind closed doors or in facilities, if they do see something that looks wrong or it looks like there's a bruise or whatever the case may be, then they're mandated to make that report. Police officers are in that category. Also, all emergency room, of course, anyone that works in facilities are in that category. So we become their eyes and ears, those of us that work in medical or law enforcement or whatever the case may be. So it takes more people to bring it to surface, and then and only then do the other agencies get involved. But it doesn't mean that they have Alzheimer's or dementia and they're incapable of reporting. A lot of the times it's a physical dependency and not a mental dependency. But the abuser has total control of power and control and intimidation over the dependent older person. And even though they have a telephone in the house, they will not make that phone call because they have been threatened by the abuser not to do it or else. So that this very intricate, all of the reasons why we don't know that the abuse is going on.
When you look at these cases, and of course there are more ways to investigate and prosecute than just with the statement, but you're right, there's other ways to get the information from them. You put your case together, but you also have to train. And whether it's healthcare professionals or law enforcement, and you've mentioned this already, or family members, social services, you name it, you have to admit there's probably some out there that aren't looking for the signs that are readily available. And what must we do to train our professionals to recognize these signs?
Well, I think it's not only training, but I think we should train it across the board and across disciplines. I can remember when I first started, I had no idea about elder abuse on that first case in 1985. I stumbled onto a scene that was absolutely horrendous, in my opinion, and handled it as a criminal case, and it was a case of elder abuse of a daughter to her father. What we found that worked really well, and I think is the best approach, is multidisciplinary. You get your medical people and your hospital people, along with your protective services and law enforcement, because you have to tackle the case and get it ready for prosecution in court if that's where it's going to be handled. And you want the best evidence possible. The evidence can cry out in court, whereas the victim may not. But as you say, only through training and cross-training and training together and understanding everyone's role in these cases so that we can collaborate and work together and not work against each other and think that we're going over into somebody else's territory. And I think that's a great lesson, that we can all do it in a collaborative way and not think that we're encroaching and taking over somebody else's role in these particular cases. We should work together, not against one another.
Lillian Jeter's here. She's an expert in elder abuse issues. Thinking about the victim, and they're being victimized by their son, their daughter, their grandson, their niece, nephew, whatever. They're terrified. They know that they need the help. They're in a home. It could be an employee of the home that's victimizing them. And they're afraid. They're afraid to come forward because it is their daughter or someone that they care for. And they're threatened into doing things that they wouldn't normally do. How do we now educate those that may be potential victims or are victims?
That's really hard. I think the main thing is to those that are in senior groups, those that meet out in the community, that are still proactive, that still go and meet as a group in a setting, whether informal or formal. Those are the ones that we need to get the information to and say, it's not happening to you, but it could. It may be happening in your family. Family dynamics are very hard. And all the cases that I have done, and Dana, as of, believe it or not, August of 2015, I'll have had 30 years in this, in elder abuse issues alone, and handling cases. And in all of those years, I've seen so many cases and family dynamics. And the families will know that this is happening, but there will be those in the family that are weaker than the others, and the strong ones will be the abusers. And sometimes they abuse together and collaborate together against the weaker, with the victim, you know, the mother or the father in the middle. And that's horrendous. Or oftentimes we see, believe it or not, professionals who are abusers.
Absolutely.
Those that are in professional roles. Or, as you say, those who are medical persons that work in nursing homes or assisted living facilities that are supposed to be delivering care, not mistreating. So how do you break those cycles? How do you make people voice their concern and say something is happening here, or become eyewitnesses and make that report and tell the administration, or make that call to police or to the hotlines or whatever, to the dispatch center? I mean, these are very, very hard questions and very, you know, intricate things that must be done. But it's taking that step, knowing these people, it's not a one-off. They're being neglected and abused and physically assaulted every single day in some capacity, in some form, and they are totally unable to defend themselves. And this might go on for years.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Lillian Jeter's here talking about elder abuse and the issues. Now, we've talked about law enforcement and the system, so to speak, and education, and you've done a lot of media. Television, radio.
Quite a bit.
Television, radio, you name it, you've done it. But, you know, when you sit down again, I talk about Joe and Mary Sixpack at home in North Dakota or in Hawaii or in Saskatchewan, Canada, that really don't think about it unless it's, you know, directly affecting their family. We don't see a lot of it you know, focused on in the media. I know you have done some work. What more can the media do as far as keeping this a active discussion?
Well, I think that's one of the problems. And let's get down to causative factors. I think one of the causative factors that it is hidden behind closed doors of whatever environment, so to speak, is our view of those that are aging. You know, a lot of those in society do not revere those and look up to and you know, sing the praises of those who are older and weaker and have spent their time and are now, you know, in their twilight years, so to speak, and who may be infirm now and not competent, losing their faculties, dementia has set in, whatever the case.
Right.
It's children that are our future. And I wonder where society went wrong that we don't look to those who have, you know, gone before us, so to speak, and look up to them and learn from them. You see what I'm saying?
Right, absolutely.
And that causative factor is called ageism. Look how the elderly are depicted on TV commercials. Look how the elderly are depicted in TV shows and on movies. They're not smart and intelligent and the hero of the segment. They're laughed at, they're incompetent, they're silly, they're what they say is stupid. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
They're ridiculed. And this goes on all the way down to those who are in kindergarten. This is what they learn as they're growing up. So it's little wonder that this isn't one of those topics that's a daily concern or you know, you see all the outrage and indignant response when there's children that are abused, and rightfully so. But where is that same indignant response when we have an elder abuse case that comes out once in a while, so to speak?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's not there. Society doesn't want to know about. They don't want to know about what's going on behind in closed doors behind a nursing home, because that's a place that they don't go to and they don't want to go to.
You're
so
right.
Don't tell me what's going on behind closed doors. I don't want to know it is Mr. and Mrs. Public sitting at home in cozy conditions. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, vulnerability is a key word. We talk about protecting the vulnerable, young children, handicapped, elderly. in this case. But the vulnerability that's out there and the predators that are out there to take advantage of that vulnerability need to be, I'm an old school cop that thinks that if you do the crime, you've got to do the time. And I know in this country, we're more of a rehabilitative society. And when you do the crime, you don't necessarily do the time. What about the United States? Is there strong enough law when it comes to elder abuse?
Well, one of the problems with the United States is there are different laws on the books in various states.
Right.
So a problem with all the categories, whether it be reporting or uniform, you know, statistics or whatever the case may be, is uniformity among the 50 states, and that causes problems, as you can well imagine. I can remember in my case in 1985, I had to find a 1974 case that had been put on the books that made it a crime to abuse, neglect, and exploit an incapacitated person over the age of, there was a particular age there. And that law was put on the books by the lawmakers in South Carolina in 1974. This was 1985. It had never been utilized. I had to knock the dust off of the law book and find it because nobody knew it existed to make that first criminal case. Now, that should not be. And I'm afraid there's a lot of law books out there that are not being utilized, and these types of now better developed laws are on the books, because these are crimes, Dana. These are not social situations. These are crimes being committed against those who cannot fight back, who are incapacitated, who are vulnerable, either physically and or mentally, and who have given their life for the betterment of our communities and raised families and raised grandchildren and built businesses to form what we have in our communities today. And this is how we treat them in their later years, is my question.
Yeah. It's despicable.
It's the implementation of laws and the collaboration of getting that law enforcement in at the same time as the report comes in, because evidence is precious and evidence should be gotten immediately and processed immediately.
If we can't protect the vulnerable, then I'm not sure who we can protect, Lillian. And you and I took an oath many, many years ago to do that. And whether we're doing it the way we're doing it right now, or whether we're doing it in an active investigation or getting the word out, I think it's so important. I'll give you the last word as far as elder abuse, and I think we'll do some follow-up shows. What would you like the people to know?
I would like the people to know that it does occur. It's not a one-off type of crime. It is occurring every single day. And if they walk out their front door right now and look up and down the street of their particular pristine neighborhood, it's happening on their street. If there are older people there behind closed doors, if it isn't happening directly beside them, it's happening behind them or two doors down or two streets down. And the more money that the older person that's behind those closed doors has, the more the temptation to start the abuse. And it happens in many forms. It happens to the best of families, the worst of families, and all the families in between. There's no one that's immune to being victimized. And it is a crime. It is horrendous. If we sit here and we shudder and we grimace at what happens to children, then those same acts are being committed at the upper part of the age scale, even more continuously, because the resources and the willingness to act on these types of crimes is just not the same. It's not the same immediacy and the same importance. And to me, that's the shame of society, whether it be in the United States or Canada or Australia or wherever.
Absolutely. Lillian Jeter, expert in elder abuse issues. Click on the link in the show notes to learn more about Lillian and to learn more about elder abuse. Thank you, ma'am. We'll be in touch, and we'll do this again.
Thank you a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Lillian Jeter, former law enforcement officers, an expert in elder abuse. And again, I say it, if we can't protect the vulnerable, and that includes the elderly, I'm not sure who we can protect. Well, that's it. I want to thank my guest this evening, Jason Miller, discussing his new book, Obamacare, Healthcare Apocalypse. Click on the link to pick up that book from Amazon and other book retailers. And, of course, Lillian Jeter talking about elder abuse. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll see you again real soon. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.